Thanks, Mike. I think most of the things that could be said, Frank, to you have almost certainly been said, but let me suggest two things. One, one is that it has been an extraordinary experience of mine to have worked with a lot of people in this world who have been willing to say what it is that they really have thought competently about to whomever it is that needs to be said. And you rank at the very top among those people who are willing to do that, and I think it's one of the most important, perhaps the most important thing for this particular field, and it's the thing I most admire. I also want it to be noted that you haven't sort of slid through life as the Mr. Nice Guy that you were described as last night. You're actually extremely competent, sort of seizing opportunities. I will never forget the time that you came to give a speech so that we could learn something about nuclear waste at Crespin, New Jersey. And 2 weeks later, David was telling me that he had an offer from Vanderbilt to come down and run the department. And 4 years later, here it is. I'm a part of your department. So, if that's Mr. Nice Guy, it works beautifully. But anyhow, I'm happy to be here, and thanks for everything that you have done and helping in every way to make Crespa an entity that I think is in fact continuing to say what it needs to do to a wide range of folks who care about the issues that we all care about. Let's go on to the, if I can get around this thing. Let's go ahead into the next. I've got two things to say about the role of philosophers in this thing. This is a relatively complex quote. It comes from the MIT Future of Nuclear Power study from 2004, and it's how I have thought that most people in the technical field think about what philosophers ought to do. In this report, they're kind of wondering about whether or not issues associated with partitioning and transmutation should be, the evaluation of them should be changed by virtue of the fact that that in fact after a period of time when the strontium particularly the cesium are gone, that in fact the reasons to worry about people deciding to go after the valuable stuff that is no longer there's no longer a barrier for outweighs the issues associated with trying to in fact go through the process of carrying out that partitioning and transmutation. And so what they do, in fact, is say is the value of the day is initiating the technical means for one particular type of aggressive or malevolent human behavior. Centuries or millennia from now, out of all possible opportunities for such behavior that may exist at the time, is a question perhaps addressed by philosophers better than by engineers, political scientists, or economists. Which means, of course, when you get to a question you don't have any answer to, then you turn to the philosophers. And in fact, you don't think it's a question that can be answered, so you have them talk a bit and then go on and make your own judgment, which is precisely what they went ahead and did. But then it turns out that I come to this conference, and most of the people who are talking here are technical people, and what they ended up doing is all giving ethics lectures. You may have noticed that the opportunity for me to say something new at this point in relation to anything that is my field has already been covered at least more generally by almost everybody I'm going to talk about, almost everybody who I'm going to follow. So why don't we go ahead to the next slide. I want to talk for a minute about four things that I first noted about what came out of the 1979 report, because we are, at this point, I think, trying to figure out sort of how we might actually figure out whether or not we need to start again, or whether or not we can, in fact, somehow go on from where we are with some of the basic things that we've learned over the last 30 years. 30 years, effectively 30 years ago, in 2 months from now, the president did, in fact, appoint a group within a very competent group within his administration to try to figure out these issues that we can go to the. And they began with what his fundamental premise was, that in relation to some of the civilian issues, there was going to be no processing for moral reason related to proliferation risk and the fact that it wasn't needed. And so that, therefore, defined it as waste. The work on trying to deal with the spent nuclear fuel and high-level waste was not to be deferred to future generations. And the way in which it was going to be managed was not to depend in any way on human intercedents. And the way in which that was going to be dealt with was to be completely separate from the biosphere. Now, they said three other fundamental things in that document, it seems to me, that sort of stood in interesting and complex relationship to those four factors. Their concern with regionality and technically based site selection were really issues associated with how better to assure both protectiveness and fairness in that process. The issues associated with retrievability were complexly related to, again, normative concepts of protectiveness and freedom of future generations to choose, and the relationship between the passive and active tension that was raised up here in this issue was, in fact, sort of put in relief here. One of the things I think has been fascinating in this conference is our work to try to understand whether the retrievability is something where we simply wait to see if something goes wrong, or if, in fact, we're actually actively part of trying to figure out some way in which the future generations are actually given an opportunity to choose. And the issue that they made very clear that before anything could happen, page 47 of this document, before anything could happen, you had to achieve social consensus on the program's scientific evidence in order to be allowed to go forward at all. Now, what was it that led them to say those four things that were pretty straightforward and pretty simple, and then those three things that were really much more complex normatively? What characteristics led the IRG to say that we should handle management of these issues differently from how we handle other waste? Was it toxicity severity, toxicity durability, what the materials did before they became waste, i.e., built bombs, or what analogous material in terms of the SNF did before they became waste, or the material is made by human beings and unnatural, or what someone may do to harm others if they have access to the waste of the material? It seems to me that we have, in one sense or another, dealt with all of those questions pretty effectively in the context of this discussion, and have found, actually, that they are not somehow something that requires us to do something completely distinctively different in a way in which I think that the IRG report, in some sense, did suggest that we did. Now, what happened then, it seems to me, the reason I had those four issues up at the top earlier, and I had these three over here, is because it seems to me that we took those four issues, no reprocessing, not to be deferred to future generations, separate from the biosphere, and no dependence on human intercedents, and in 1982, and then in, what was that, 3 years after TMI, and then in 1987, 1 year after Chernobyl, we did in fact put a box around those and said and boxed ourselves in my judgment, to a way of handling all of those questions that effectively excluded any way in which we were going to go through these processes. Because by the time that we had taken the issues not to be deferred to future generations and made them part of how we, in fact, thought about the issues of no human intercedents and separate from the biosphere, separated from the issues associated with regionality and technically based site selection, had us define four Nevadans, the future that they, in 1975, had been interested in by the time 1987 came along, were pretty furious about how having imposed upon them. The social consensus on the part of the program's evidence as being essential, part and parcel of that was not only the fact that people needed to be part of that participation process, but also that the other forms of government would be in fact part of it. The passive active tension that was always in tension with that particular principle was knocked out by the way in which we put in 82 and 87 this box around those 1979 conclusions. We can go forward now. Now, I want to talk about what may, in fact, have been part of why we got ourselves into that problem. I don't know how many of you know Mary Warnock's Imagination book. It's really quite something, 1976, in which she exquisitely analyzes how it is that Immanuel Kant came to think that Hume was wrong in thinking that things were that the human mind simply was that against which the sensations sort of banged around and became chaotic. But the way in which the human imagination was the mechanism by which it's possible to explain that how human beings put in time and space their experience. Images in time and space is fundamental to how it is that what goes on. But the problem is that when we go about that process as human beings, it's important to recognize that the images we're dealing with can, in many contexts, become those mechanisms by which we don't have intelligible thought, but in fact you lose track of it. Spencer Weert's book, Nuclear Fear, A History of Images, I think is an extraordinary piece of work. If you haven't read it, you cannot go forward in this field without knowing it, because it is an analysis of how we began with a kind of duplicity already in the very beginnings back in the before the 1900s of thinking through how to think about issues associated with transmutation, which then got taken directly into radioactivity, into the question of how it is that the images that the society framed around both nuclear power and its relationship to what it is that nuclear power first did to human beings and our use of it, build up through that a set of images through which I don't think it is possible to not understand why it is that we've had so much trouble dealing with this problem. And what he did is, as an historian of images, is look through the materials of every description and find for a given group of people what pictures, symbols, beliefs, rational concepts, feelings, and emotions have become strongly associated with one another in a cluster that includes a particular subject, such as nuclear energy. It is impossible to think about what facts are, and therefore to begin to try to relate them to normative concepts without sort of understanding the power of those images in shaping what it is we think we're dealing with. And if we don't understand that epistemological point, I don't think there's a chance we'll ever get anything right normatively. I'm going to try to talk about that a little more. He goes on to say, I do not mean that our minds are helpless before inexorable pressures, for images do not just happen among people. They are built in pointing out the tremendous dangers we face with the power of imagery, whether this power is consciously used by propagandists or whether we impose it unwittingly upon one another. I'm not preaching pessimism. To the contrary, it's only when we see clearly all the strengths of a danger that we feel capable of opposing it. The images that sit around the questions we're dealing with, failure to understand them, failure to continue to remember the kind of role that they have played in our thought processes, where the mind goes. Mr. Nemec did a good job yesterday of reminding us how all those sort of fundamental initial images captured by those pictures shape the way in which anybody begins to bring normative concepts to bear on this set of problems, okay? Okay, so now what ethical concepts are relevant? What I've begun to say to you is we have something in which facts are bound up in intelligible thought with images that lead to conflicting factors in our perception of what it is that we're dealing with. And we're trying to come up with some way of thinking through a management program that, in fact, will sort of meet our responsibilities. Now, what we actually have up here, what the concepts that are actually relevant, therefore, are those which we found all of ourselves talking to. Almost everybody here has talked about protecting the public. The procedural factors Cole Glaser picked up on, distributional factors, but then almost everyone picked up on those distributional factors. Most people have talked about fairness. The evidentiary issues Cole Glaser began with, and then we had this sort of wonderful definition of evidentiary proof that Bob Budnis gave. Beautiful piece today. I don't know if you noticed it. You know, he takes us through analysis and the dependence upon models. And then when it gets to the sort of tougher issues that we're trying to deal with here, what he says is, it seems to me. And that's where we have to come out in relation to the way in which the data we have in relation to the problem we're trying to analyze so far in the future, it seems to me may be our best criterion for what it is. And the question is, we'll come back to Bob in a few minutes about that. Participation and self-determination, Isaac Sturgeson, have all sort of made that part of us. I want to talk also about responsibility and for what some people have talked about, that really it's Sprotz and Isaacs who sort of raised the question of who is responsible. I'm certainly going to come back and take a look at that and then how and what way we're responsible. But I want to come back and sort of say a lot of what we've been talking about throughout this conversation is informed consent. Isaacs, Caspersen, Greenberg, many others, and its relationship to coercion. I really feel as if, uh, as if uh, the presentation you heard just before lunch has actually got at that in a beautiful way. I'm not sure I'll do much better on that. Then the relationship of those issues, the truth-telling, almost everybody talked about that in some way, promise-keeping for some, but it was very unclear. It is systematically unclear in these conversations. Okay, can you hit the next one? It's whether or not these issues associated with truth-telling are because it's right, or the issues of promise-keeping is because it's right, or because in fact it somehow will help us get something we want to get done. We'll come back to that in a few minutes as well. Before we jump into more specific evaluation of how to think forward from where we are, remembering Frank's admonition that the only reason we want to look back to the past is to remember what it is we want not to do again, in this particular case it is. Sometimes we learn something that we want to do. I'm afraid in this case it's so many things we don't want to do. I want to talk about something that Cass Sunstein said in a brand new book that actually Frank sort of put me onto recently, and I've found it enormously useful. One of my goals, Cass Sunstein says, is to identify a set of heuristics that now influence not only factual but also moral judgments in the domain of risk, to try to make plausible the claim that some widely held practices and beliefs that are product of those heuristics, often risk-related heuristics, represent generalizations from a range of problems for which they are indeed well-suited. And hence, most of the time, the heuristics work well. The problem comes when generalizations are wrenched out of the context and treated as freestanding or universal principles applicable to situations in which the justifications no longer operate. Because the generalizations are treated as freestanding or universal, their application seems obvious, and those who reject them appear morally obtuse, even monstrous. I want to urge that the appearance is misleading and even productive of moral mistakes. There's nothing obtuse or monstrous about refusing to apply a generalization in context in which the rationale is absent. Let me go back to where I started a few minutes ago. I said we had four things coming out of the 1979 report that had their own sort of obvious and sort of intuitive moral appeal. And then those things which were much more complex normatively, issues like why we wanted retrievability, and why it is we wanted to obtain social consensus, and those issues. I've lost my third one. What was the? Why don't you go forward again? No. When we got to regionality, those were complex issues that in the 1979 report were dealt with in really quite interesting ways. They were put to the test of a very diverse group of people in that IRG team. They went out, they got 3,000 responses to them, then the IRG tried to respond. In fact, they came up with a relatively coherent document. But what they had put into play with these four factors here were these enormously complex set of factors, which disallowed the possibility of sort of single normative or factual definitions of each one of these questions. And what the Congress then did is they boxed these four issues together and boxed us into the situation which we now find to be so problematic. Can we go forward dramatically to the... Okay, next one. Okay, now which of these ethical concepts are relevant? I'm suggesting that what we have here are really issues that are focused importantly around the concept of informed consent, which is going to give rise to both things that flow into it and flow back out to it that are going to be fundamental for our understanding these questions. And go ahead. And that, in fact, what we're wrestling with is trying to relate the way in which the law is related to the more ethically complex understandings in that 1979 report, which I find enormously, it's as good a piece of work as I've seen, and yet it somehow got encased in the set of laws that have been freeding us ever since. And let's go ahead and keep on moving through this. Because, in fact, we're willing to say that what actually happened to that situation is that politics began to take over. And you go ahead and sort of flow across these. Now, the question at this point is whether or not law is encompassed by ethics, or ethics is encompassed by law, or they must overlap, or they, in fact, can be allowed to be separate. But, in fact, what we concluded is that, in fact, that politics took over the entire thing. They almost drove out the entire range of factual issues, let alone any kind of normative clarity. And we somehow think that that is an acceptable situation. I'm suggesting, in fact, that when in fact the country has lost the capacity in dealing with something as complex as what we're dealing with, as was recognized by the IRG report, in trying to get those seven different things on the table. We only took four of them. The politics took over. It drove us away from things we know we should be interested in, like using coercion as the sole basis for it. And so now what we're left with is a situation in which the relationship between law and ethics that we need in this particular case, I'm going to argue, to be intimate, if we have any chance of overcoming the power of imagery in relation to the complex moral situation, which we have, as Casperson said so well today, created such enormous distrust around, this cannot be the answer. I'll never forget walking into Tom Grumbly's office in 1995 after having sort of spent a year sort of trying to understand what was actually happening to the EM program, as Mark knows well. I had by 1991 concluded that we were not going to be able to get, and had told EPRI this, that we were not going to be able to get Yucca open without having at least a ongoing process of looking for a second repository and or operative through the waste negotiator or some other mechanism, some way of having at least two other places where we're going to end up having centralized storage. And I walked in and I said, you realize, Tom, that you can't go anywhere in your program. What is fundamentally underlying the possibility of you going anywhere is that the stuff that really, people really care most about, you keep on telling them every 6 months there's going to be some different six-month period, and you keep on drawing that whole thing out for long periods of time. I already saw that back in 1995, and Tom went, shh. And we have been saying, folks, for the last 14 to 15 years, and most of us know that we've been on a path that probably wasn't going to get there. But we always treated it as several people have said today, as if it was only 6 months away from, in fact, being resolved. As if we only waited another 6 months, we would be able to move the entire process. And so we've been saying around the issues that are fundamentally mistaken in this whole thing, not having clarified what our fundamental normative bases are, not having taken our generalizations more specifically to the very complex problem made worse by the way in which we did the law, and all we can say about it is shh. And I'm asking, are we ready to start to try to figure out again, and how does ethics inform how to do it? Okay. I think it goes back to this question. Of course there's going to be politics lying behind these things, but I don't think there's a chance of getting there in this issue unless what it is that the leadership of this country knows, in whatever mechanism it chooses to do it, that it's got to put the politics in the context of what it moves toward law to do with as defined by an effective ethical evaluation. What is the relationship that must exist in order for you to make progress on nuclear waste? I don't think we're going to get there. And what I'm hearing from the places where it's happening, or the places where we've made it happen, as in the case of WIP, is we got all that right, folks. And everything else, where we've gotten it wrong, we're absolutely nowhere and probably going backwards. Okay? Promises, promises. I think that what Casperson said today was extremely effective. False promises, deceptive or opaque, disingenuous, and simply not kept. Don't promise what you can't deliver. And when you have failures, instead of promising and then deliver, the only mechanism for building trust, especially now, is that. And the question is, who has the capacity to create the perceptions of fairness, protectiveness, and respect for choice necessary to gain informed consent? In other words, what is it that we say that our institutional arrangements that will actually get all of those things right in the context of the images which operate around nuclear issues and nuclear waste, in order to allow informed consent as a pure concept to function? And can those with whom trust has been lost ever recover it? That is a fundamental question. Somebody has to decide that question pretty early on, because the issue of whether or not to continue to keep on pushing where we are with the coercive force to try to figure out some way to rebuild trust in the light of this context, or to start in some fundamentally new way, or at least to go in a different path for a while until we ever come back to it, in the ways that several people have suggested, perhaps by going in with lesser quantities or a certain kind of the high level SNF mix, strikes me as fundamental. Can we go to the next one? Informed consent is not simply participation, involvement, and communication. It really isn't that. Why is that? Informed, accurate, and understandable depiction of the issues that are or are believed to be things about which people should be concerned. That means, in the context of the images we've been talking about, an extremely complex situation. Informing people, I do a sort of constant epidemiology. Every time I get into a vehicle, a conveyance of any sort, whether it's someone sitting beside me or the driver of the cab or whatever, and I keep trying to figure, what is it that people know about this? The level of information out there is unbelievably low about these issues, although everybody knows yucca, and the yucca isn't going anywhere. Clarifying the relationship of the issue under review to those other issues affected by and affecting the interests of those being informed. How is it, and I think that Roger was right in raising this question, how is it, do we really understand the relationship between being informed about the nuclear waste management issues with the other issues that for us seem so obviously related in terms of both climate change and, as he so, I think, brilliantly yesterday suggested, Tom did, the real relationship between our being willing to do SNF takeback and some fundamental national security issues. The issues of informed and consent versus coercion. What is our standard? Is law and legislative procedures our standard? Well, the IRG says that this was it, or at least overwhelming acceptance of what was actually happening. The IRG said that, in fact, we couldn't get there unless we had not just a majority of the folks in the Congress say they're going to impose something on Nevada, but this had to be there with both the underlying data and the normative concepts at work. That's a strong claim. They didn't think we could do it otherwise. Relationship between choice and consent. Is there a way of creating the perception of choice in the absence of something like centralized alternatives or a second or third repository at this point? That's a fundamental contextuating decision this country has to make. Is it possible to get informed consent, and given the history of what's gone on, without, in fact, opening up other alternatives in this sort of ways? Several councils of prudence with a deontological base. Josh Lederberg asked me to go talk to the advisory committee on the environment for the Navy at one point. And I thought hard, because I'd known that they were dealing with a couple of really complex issues. And I thought, should I tell them what I actually believe, which is I don't think that you will ever win an important environmental controversy unless, in fact, what you do, in fact, have is something like the informed consent of the overwhelming of a consensus or overwhelming acceptance of the range of people who are going to be involved. That shook the Navy up. It turned out that they came back not long after that and said that they thought I was right. MCHCA was an example where the Department of Energy was at war with the state of Alaska, almost every Alaskan I ever met, including all the Aleuts, about whether or not there were radionuclides in the Bering Sea. Now, the question was, how do you get something like this where there is a major controversy like that, and how do you get the role of expertise working in such a way that you can get this going? We decided the only way to possibly make that happen is to take the Aleuts who were of most concern with us on that expedition so they knew precisely what it was that we were doing in the course of developing the data, both physical and the biotic from both the North Atlantic and from the Bering Sea. It turned out that the only way to win that particular situation was not to get some, to force some model through or so forth, but to build a consensus with overwhelming acceptance among all the people who were really effectively affected by that. I'm just finishing. I've had a pretty quite interesting experience as I've been the head of CREST over the last few years. I have, for this, in 1997, at the request of the New York Academy of Sciences, I pulled together a group of people who looked at whether or not, by examining the contaminants in the New York-New Jersey Harbor Consortium, we could come up with a way of understanding what their sources were and to figure out some way of developing a set of recommendations for five different contaminants in the harbor. About 70 organizations had participated in that process, and for every, and Leslie knows this particularly, is Leslie still here? She was a few minutes ago. For every one of those contaminants, we developed a wide range of fairly aggressive practices by which people in the entire watershed would reduce the flow of mercury, cadmium, PCBs, because PCBs, only 5% of all PCBs have been sequestered, incidentally, even though we abandoned them 25 years ago. But dioxins and PAHs. And it was possible by having set up a process where the entire way in which information, the way in which people were informed, was related to consent, allowed for consensus on every single one of the recommendations made over that 7-year period. I think it is in fact possible, in fact perhaps the only way to go forward on these issues, to work for that definition of what it is that consent involves in these questions. And I think it goes well beyond what we've seen anybody to this point attempt to do in relation to the risk management issues. Who could make the Bob Budnitz presentation and be overwhelmingly accepted? Or is Roger Casperson right? You cannot go back again. That's a really important conversation. That Bob Budnitz was dealing with a set of issues that tried to figure out how to think long-term into the future. What would it take to create that kind of environment, to allow that kind of consent with adequately informed people to make that process work? I think that's our challenge. I think it's the ethical challenge. Go ahead. Because then we have to try to figure out who and what organizational context will work for that purpose. Now, we basically sort of start out by saying, okay, the people who caused the injury are the people who are going to be responsible for it. That's the way we handle it, you know. The polluter must pay. In this particular case, not only the polluter must pay, but in fact, in our country, the polluter must figure out how to manage the situation. In that case, it creates very interesting dilemmas for the Department of Energy, who is both the regulator and the responsible party. So we started out there, and then we very quickly figured out that we weren't actually going to leave the people who had in fact put the SNF, put the fuel rods through their reactors and created SNF. In fact, the United States government was going to take over responsibility for that. Well, why would we have said that? It's because we thought that because there was sufficient risk of injury and the proximity and capacity to address the injury or reduce the injury and be the last resort for someone who could do it, that had to go to the United States government. And that was the right way to handle the question. And next one. Okay. And now we're beginning to ask the question, was that understanding of the capacity responsibility in relationship to the role responsibility we saw for it that divided those issues up between public and private, was that any way, in fact, to see those questions working effectively? Or we saw that move across. Go ahead. We've begun to move over to role responsibility and... Now we're sort of beginning to question what this, a new public-private entity, would be. I think that what we're looking for, that would be capable of creating the informed consent and sufficiently distancing itself from those levels of distrust because of failed promises in the past, but would have to have the technical capacity to, in fact, to address those, and probably to have sufficient authorization within the context of the United States government, giving it both, as people have suggested, consistent sources of compensation, but also ways in which they could effectively operate in certain circumstances with certain kinds of governmental authority. The issue of how to put these concepts to work to try to figure out what it is that would actually work, you can't continue to give the responsibility in this case to any institution or structure that can't pull these issues together in the context of creating anything else but informed consent of a nearly universal sort to deal with the problem of the failures that we've seen. The next one. So it seems to me that where we have come from is we had a group of people who were enormously creative at the time. It's fascinating to go back and sort of look at what in fact they said, because as people have continued to say, so much has not changed as well as what has, in addition to the things we have learned. We boxed ourselves into a box because we took only 4 of the 7 pieces that the IRG had come up with. And it seems to me that, in fact, what we need is a way of sort of thinking those questions through. And anything that suggests that the way in which we handle these questions in the future in terms of legally can somehow be left to politics as usual, or to the political obliteration of the proper relationship between the ethical understandings, which I think we know are both counsels of prudence and, as Tom Isaacson said, doing it because it's the right thing, I think will fail. And so therefore, I'm hoping that what David Cosson picks up this afternoon is a way of sort of carrying those issues forward. Thank you.